Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Yesterday we started to have a conversation that got a few of you a little annoyed, which is all the reason to have more of the conversation. What am I talking about? Well, the example that I gave was King David Schools had their matric dance a few days after the Omicron variant was spoken about in South Africa. A lot of kids, as far as we know, have now tested positive. Some of their parents have tested positive. The reaction is maybe people have shaken their heads and they've reacted to it, but not really. If I contrast that to the ways in which some of us, and I include myself, reacted some months ago when some religious Jewish weddings, for example, went ahead and some of the synagogues went ahead when they shouldn't have, the reaction there was much more severe. Even though these things are being reported, I'm not sure that they are reported in the same way with the same level of emotion. And I believe that that potentially impacts on the reaction. We wanted to find out a little bit more about reporting in media, using emotion in media, and how that influences us. William Bird is the Director of Media Monitoring Africa. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Hi, good morning, Howard. Thanks for having me on the program.
So it's great to chat to you. The way in which we've seen media move, in other words, towards moving away from the generalized to the specifics in order to make it relatable, but often that tells very personal stories, that has a very real impact on us and our responses, doesn't it?
Yeah, it can and it does. You know, certainly the information we get and the more emotive it tends to be, often the stronger our reaction can be to that. Of course, the flip side to that is that we're a nation that is already living with so much trauma that in order to elicit a kind of strong emotional response, you know, you have to increasingly make the scenario more and more shocking and appalling. And we've seen this, you know, historically, if you go back, you'll see that what our media used to do in the mid to late 90s was that as we would get towards the end of the year, there was reports on things like gender-based violence, and you'd see one shocking report, and then you'd see another one. And in order for people to get that same kind of shock and outrage, it had to be more and more extreme. And you get to that point where it's like, you know, you saw like up to Baby Chapang, for example, where it was allegedly 9 people who raped an infant. And your mind just can't begin to comprehend the horror of that kind of thing, you know. So the danger of that is it's a powerful thing and it can have the right effect. You know, if you think of some of the most powerful historical photographs that have been used by our media to elicit emotion and get some kind of response. You know, if you talk about the 76 uprising or you talk about some of those kinds of images that are associated with that, it immediately elicits some kind of response. And had we not had those powerful images, maybe we wouldn't have seen the kind of changes that we would from certain people. But as I said, the danger is that you kind of then flip to being more and more extreme, so you desensitize. The other danger to it, of course, is that these days, pushing your buttons on or using your emotions is one of the most powerful tools. It's kind of one of the things that social media drives and thrives on, you know. And there you see the danger of that being that it's used by people wanting to spread mis- and disinformation.
So I think that is the thing. As you were talking, I was thinking about the Syrian refugee crisis that really changed when we saw the picture of a 2-year-old washed up on a beach. That to me is one of the most emotive photos, and it did good. As shocking as it is, because suddenly the world started to pay attention to this major crisis. So it can be used for good. The problem is that we are also manipulated by these types of images. Sometimes they're not even real.
Yeah, and often, you know, marketers particularly use these kinds of things to elicit that response. Often it's about this idea that you aren't good enough, or you should feel guilty or bad if you don't have X, Y, or Z product, or you know, you're not, your body image isn't good enough. So that's a very common kind of thing. And when you then speak about the role of news and media, it's not that, you know, it's not to elicit a response. It is there to inform you, to give you the information that you can then use to make an informed decision, so that you don't just get, because what you don't want is people just responding in a like-minded manner, which is to say, you know, just going out and being wildly angry. You don't want that, you know, because that doesn't mm-hmm. help people. Mm-hmm. What you want is, if it's around migration, you want them to say, well, what are the causes of this? How do we fix it? What role can I play? What is our government doing this? Do we have the right policies? If we aren't, what, where can I intervene? What are the good things? What are the bad things? What are the push, the pull? You know, there's a whole, it's a very, very complex series of issues, and you want people to be able to think through and engage with that. The moment you just get people so angry or so outraged or shocked, you often then don't empower them to act. And in South Africa, we run the very real risk of leaving people either numb or just, you know, in between about what to do and how to react to that. And that's not a good thing. We want more people in South Africa to say, hang on, whatever the situation is, we need to react. So to come back to your starting point, you know, when you saw that, you said, well, why wasn't the anger? And maybe it's because there's so much fatigue. We've already so traumatized of living through this damn pandemic that people were just like, oh no, again, how do we even deal with this? And, but also because we can understand the complex decisions that would have gone into saying, well, do we go ahead? Don't we go ahead? I mean, I had the same with my team. We were meant to have a meeting this week, and eventually we said, no, we're not going to, right? But you make those decisions, but again, as your role as media would be to say, well, let's give the people the information they need to make an informed choice. This is why we think you shouldn't go ahead. These are the decisions why you do. If you have to have X, Y, Z thing, make sure it's in a well-ventilated space, preferably outside. It's been raining the last few days, but, you know, generally speaking, go wild, meet outside in the shade. And that's a much better way. Double mask, et cetera, et cetera. If you held it, all of those sorts of things that we need to give people and remind them of why we're doing this, so that it's not a case of just trying to stimulate them by emotion, but engage their rationality and help them understand where they can interject.
I guess one of the challenges here is, you know, we always keep saying facts matter. It's all about the facts. But the reality is that when you are reporting, when you're writing on an incident and it was, let's say, a terrible tragedy where a number of people are killed, take a world war where you write and you use numbers of in the millions, it loses its relevance because it is so removed. But if you talk about one family and one details around it, then we can relate better. Side of that is, as you say, we become completely traumatized by these things.
Yeah, but I think there are ways of helping us empathize and understand. And so again, it then comes down to which emotions are you trying to prod and how do you help people work through and navigate that? Because you're right. The Holocaust, you give the number 6 million. You know, you can't even comprehend that kind of thing. You know, you don't know what 6 million
almost
people looks like in a group, right?
Absolutely.
So so there are ways that you can then help people understand that. You can go through it to speak about the brutality. You help people see, well, this is the systems that were developed. You know, you have to help people think, well, it's not an easy thing to just kill, you know, that many people. You need a proper system. You need an administration. You need bureaucracy. And those are the kind of banal elements of that brutality and that horror. But it helps people understand that it was a planned thing and then you can help people understand and empathize with what individuals have gone through. And, you know, there are countless excellent examples of exactly that, of people being able to go, okay, this is the impact it had on this individual, on this family, on these people. And but then again, it's not a matter of then of necessarily being outraged and angry about it, but it is about then being able to empathize with some of that. And again, because what you want is for people to be able to say, well, this is so horrific, this is so awful, we want to make sure that this and this and this thing doesn't ever happen again. What do we need to do to make sure that a young body doesn't want to wash up on a beach, to make sure that those who've got evil intentions, you know, to kill lots or exterminate just because they don't like the look of the, or the religion of people. How do we make sure that we don't allow that. Because if you're just angry and you just want to hate, it doesn't encourage, calm, rational action that actually finds solution and that finds progress. And if you look at the kind of changes, so again, it's not to say that there's no space for those things, but if it's the core device that you use, at some point it's going to blow up in your face. And these days what we see with the disinformation, it's used chiefly in that instance to wash over the fact that there are more holes in their argument than there are in, 20 million blocks of Swiss cheese.
So, in other words, emotion is used as a cover up. So that we don't ask the real questions or look at the fact.
So you say, look at this dead child. Isn't it horrific? The child was killed by the virus. Mm. We must stop it. And you're so traumatized of, oh my goodness, look, there's a dead child. How do you know? And that's a very emotive, horrific thing. Even if you don't have children, most people can kind of understand the horror and trauma of that, right? But then you don't go, well, hang on a minute. How do we know that this child did indeed die because of the vaccine? How do we know that this is in fact a South African child? How do we know, all of these things? But if you just use that as a tool to shock, which is why news won't do that, right? Any decent journalism should never ever do that. You don't just say, here's the dead child. You have to say, this is why we've chosen to use it. This is where the child was found. This is what led to the cause of this child's tragic death, and being washed up on the beach, so that you've got a very clear understanding of.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 8:50. I'm Howard Feldman. A very good morning to you. So apologies. William and I were having the most wonderful, wonderful conversation. What we didn't realize is that you were not part of it because something went wrong with the broadcasting. We are back. So, William, I've got no idea where everybody got lost along the way. But one of the questions that I was asking you is, I was saying that when I go through overseas publications, places like the New York Post, for example, they often lead with an opinion piece rather than a report, a piece of journalism. And it's sometimes very confusing because that is infused almost the whole way through. And if we look at American media, we see places like Fox completely on the one side versus a CNN on the other. And it's almost like they're living in different realities. Now they're not. They're living in the same place, but you would think that they are reporting on different countries. What does that say about a level of journalism and where we're at?
Yeah, it's a significant problem. I mean, I think that there are two things there. The first is that use and that conflation of opinion with news and verifiable evidence. And what news should be about is about verifiable evidence and analysis, So increasingly the role of media is to help us understand, all sorts of complex things. Understanding Omicron variant, what is this? How does this work? How do the vaccines work? News media can help us understand that. They can bring in experts. You can put it into kind of context and frames that non-medical people can understand. And that's a key thing. So it's not to say that they should just, report on issues in a banal manner that doesn't explain, but there is a significant difference between that and opinion. And one of the reasons that we've seen that kind of conflation is because opinion tends to be a bit sexy. It tends to elicit the emotions that we've been talking about. As opposed to, hard reporting, especially if you don't have a big, news story to, to lead with, then it's easier to get, someone saying something outrageous. Donald Trump was great for news because you knew he would say something fundamentally outrageous, out of touch with reality. And of course, the media reporting on that is itself a challenge. Locally, we've got people like Julius Malema, who know exactly how to, push that agenda and say the right kind of thing in order to get a good headline. So there's that issue of confusion and conflation of opinion with news, which is a real problem that we've got here too. And then there's that second issue of, and this is a lot of the things of what social media has done to us, is it's kind of smashed that idea of community to the extent that all of the things that we see on social media are tailored for us. It's not, and you think that there's a community there, but that they're all engineered about this idea that you're a part of that. And it gives you this idea that whatever you're seeing there is the world, because there's so much of it. you think there can't possibly be other things. And so it starts to create that kind of separate worldview. It brings in that issue of isolation, and you tend to see the same views and same opinions as that you share, because that's how the algorithms work. The problem with that, of course, is that it fuels that kind of often that binary opposition and that polarization that you've seen in the States, especially with that like Fox News and other kind of entities that actually do news, you know. And so that is itself a real challenge. And there it's because Fox has always operated on the basis of conflation of opinion with reality. And what they saw with Trump was that actually you don't even need to worry about reality anymore. You can just use your opinion and make up whatever facts you like to suit your opinion. And that's where they're no longer, you know, a news entity, but something that looks a lot closer to a propaganda machine or to a missile disinformation generating broadcaster.
Is that only true of Fox, or would that be true on the other side as well, where you've effectively got publications in the United States, and it's always easier to look further afield rather than to look at ourselves, because there we're less emotional, but where we see publications or entities, media houses in the United States aligning with Democrat or Republican, and everything follows. They almost, you can almost predict how they're going to report something, because if you're a Republican, well, then you follow one line, and if you're a Democrat, you follow another.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to a degree, that's true, and certainly the issue of then of bias makes this a complex issue. But I was actually on a call yesterday with people saying, "Oh, you know, when are we going to start to see, you know, hardcore ultra left wing extremist disinformation? Because as it by and large, that you know, it's not." It's kind of the politics of that thing generally don't feed that, because it's based on a different set of assumptions. So if you say, okay, Fox News against the New York Times, well, yes, because the one is clearly aligned with the Democrats, but that doesn't mean that their news isn't verifiable and that they don't make clear distinctions between their opinion pages and their news. So they're going to look for stories that then share that
news. So it almost
speak to their audiences. But that's a very different thing. And in South Africa, when it comes to that kind of issue, our media is so desperate not to kind of offend too many that actually the good side of that is that it means that it's a lot harder for our media to be overtly in favor of the ANC or the DA or the EFF. You know, there are few that are kind of trying that, but it's just such a risky thing for our media locally adopt that kind of approach, because they can't risk, you know, losing audience. So they end up saying, well, hang on, we don't. But also because I think we're still a new democracy, and as much as we've got challenges, there's still a sense of saying we need to be careful not to fall into that trap. And that's absolutely a very different thing from what Fox does, where they just make stuff up, right? And that's no longer news. So it's fine to, you know, well, I think, you know, in news terms, to have a entity that overtly supports Republicans. The problem for the Republicans is that their leader for the last 5 years just made stuff up.
William, the Director of Media Monitoring Africa, I do need to leave it there. Thank you for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Taking a look at some of your messages, M says, your guest is a very wise, and C says, I must say, this guy is good. It is 8:58. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem. It's 101.9 High FM.